On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, it is our deadline day preview. We are about 10 days out from the MLB trade deadline, so we fly through some of the most important questions that will determine how this deadline unfolds. Will Tarek Skubal get traded? How many playoff caliber pitchers get moved? Who's the best hitter that switches teams? All of that and a whole lot more on this very informative episode of Baseball Barbacast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks it should be called the Trade Alive Line. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and ain't nothing about this time of year making me feel dead.
Yeah, that's an interesting edit for this time of year that we're about to get real busy. Not that you haven't been staying busy since the All-Star break following the Dodgers of Los Angeles up and down the East Coast, but this Wednesday edition of Baseball Barbacast is going to focus on that deadline arriving on August 3rd, 6 p.m. Eastern, less than 2 weeks away. We just got our first, like, oh, that's a trade between the Dodgers and Rockies. Jake can maybe tell a little funny story about his experience learning about that trade. But this episode is going to focus a lot about that trade deadline, what we are thinking about as it approaches, and that is our opener.
Deadline, August 3rd. Today is July 22nd, and I think that is important to understand that this is a fluid conversation. The teams that look like sellers today, that are cooked this morning, could be resurrected by deadline time with a hot streak, a couple series wins. This is a snapshot of a moment in time. If we had been having this conversation 2 weeks ago, the Red Sox were probably going to sell a lot of pieces away. The Blue Jays looked like buyers. Time changes very quickly. And so as we enter this discussion, it is important to remember that there's enough runway on the calendar for teams to reevaluate themselves. Teams are constantly reevaluating themselves. These teams, especially the ones in the middle, have multiple plans, multiple paths here. It is a choose your own adventure situation. If they have a bad couple of series, they're ready for those scenarios. And if they have a good couple of series, they're ready for those scenarios as well.
The one other thing I want to mention about the timeline and the fluidity of this that has sort of been alluded to, and it's sort of obvious if you keep hearing the date, August 3rd, August 3rd, August 3rd. If that feels late, that's because it is. As part of the new CBA, or the most recent CBA, the commissioner's office has the ability to kind of move the deadline around. Obviously, for years and years and years, it was July 31st, no matter when that fell. I think there were a couple exceptions if it fell on a Sunday, but generally, July 31st, that is the deadline, and that's what we got used to. Over the last half decade, it's been a little bit more fluid, where there's essentially a range of like a week, with August 3rd being, I think, the latest possible date that the commissioner can put it at, depending on the scheduling and the game scheduling and of course, the what day of the week it is. And in this case, that means it's on a Monday. But the reason I bring that up is because this year, I don't know if this is like 100% true, but just looking over the last 20 years or so, this will basically be the most games that teams have played before the deadline ever, to my general knowledge, with the way that we're looking at this. I mean, if you compare it to the last few years, I just took a couple of random samplings of teams. Most teams have played, I mean, even 10 years ago, it was between 100 and 105 games before the deadline. Whereas this year, I'm looking at teams like Toronto, Houston, Minnesota, just as a random sampling. They'll have played 112 or 113 games before the deadline. So that's two. That means two things, depending on how you look at it. One, you have more data on your team. And two, it means you are getting the players, if you're waiting all the way till the deadline, which is often the case for these teams, you're getting the players, especially for position players, for fewer games than ever before, at least in the regular season. I know the postseason is really what a lot of these teams are thinking about, but I am curious how that impacts this deadline. I'm curious if that makes it more or less likely that teams procrastinate all the way till the end because they get even more and more and more and more data, more and more, you know, adjustments to their playoff odds getting closer to October. Or does it mean that once teams are at 100 and 105 games in a week that they start making moves because they're not going to wait until they only have 60 games or 50 games left in their season? So that's just something I'm thinking about with this deadline being as late as possible.
The one other question I wanted to ask you, because I know it's something you track, is how many trades there are. I think there's been some chatter about how this year's deadline could be quieter than normal, that it is a weak free agent class, that there are more teams near the mix as we sit right now. I think there are only six teams more than six games out of a playoff spot. That's 24 teams within six games of a playoff spot or in a playoff spot. And so teams have a worse sense of who they are. You could see more clubs standing pat than usual. So for you, spreadsheet king, how many deals did we see on deadline day leading up to it last year? And what do you think the number is going to look like this year?
Yeah, I mean, so last year the deadline was on July 31st. And so, you know, a couple fewer days to work with there. We had 36 trades on deadline day last year. And I know people might only remember a couple of the big ones. We had Correa and Mason Miller, but there is pretty consistently over the last half decade, teams wait. There's maybe one or two major league trades that happen five or so days out. And then otherwise, they're waiting all the way until the end. And every year, we've gotten more and more and more where I've basically tracked how many trades we got in the last week before the deadline. And for, you know, from 2010 to, I mean, man, if you go back, I basically have looked at it for the whole 21st century. If you look at it for those 20 years from like 2000 to 2020, it was 15 to 30. Whereas over the last 5 years, it's been at least 40 every year. Last year, peaking at 63 total trades, major league trades, over the last week before the deadline. So I think that's going to happen again. Now, does that mean that we're going to be getting blockbuster after blockbuster and it's all these all-stars getting moved? Not necessarily. And we can, of course, start talking about that because I think that is a concern within the industry of that is maybe valid. But as far as the quantity and actual action and roster shuffling, I still expect that to happen again. It's just the nature of the business.
Let's start with some questions, though. Tarek Skubal, the main character of this deadline, one of the main characters of this season. Will Tarek Skubal get traded? If you are a media member and you have spent any time around a major league stadium or a minor league stadium over the last couple of months, this has dominated the proceedings. So as we sit on July 22nd, Jordan Schusterman, do you think Tarek Skubal will be traded?
I'm going to lean.
Yes or no?
I'm leaning
yes
no or today. No. Leaning no.
Leaning nope. No today.
Nope.
It's a no
leaning
day.
No. Leaning no today. I think that this experience, this is not the first time we've had this conversation, obviously, this season. The last 2 days really encapsulates the absurdity of this discussion.
Oh,
right?
So much.
I mean, Monday night, the Tigers have a miraculous victory in Chicago where Kenley Jansen, I believe, goes 3-0 against Alex Bregman with the bases loaded, where it just seemed like everything was crumbling for Kenley. And it was like, all right, this is a terrible loss. I think Ian Happ had hit a game-tying home run against Kyle Finnegan. Like, it was on the precipice of a terrible loss for Detroit. Instead, Kenley Jansen escapes. They win in extras. Season back on. What a win for the Tigers. Reinvigorated. Here they come. Tigers won again. G-Mac Cash is loving it. Tuesday night, Framber Valdez goes out and just has a terrible outing and they lose, what was it, 10-0 or something. And you're like, okay. And the point that I keep making is because the Tigers' record is so bad, every additional loss, because they haven't rattled off a Red Sox-esque winning streak or something to get back to closer to 500, makes it feel like, oh, they're screwed. Like, they have no hope. Like, that you watched last night and you said, okay, well, they're still six games under. All these teams are still in front of them. They're obviously going to trade him. So I'm trying to do my best to end up somewhere in the middle as long as they continue to yo-yo back and forth, which is what they've been doing. They've been able to avoid these slides that obviously they had earlier this season. So right now I'm still leaning no, but I don't feel good about it at all.
Currently five games out in the American League wild card race. there are one, two, three, four teams between them and the Red Sox who hold that final wild card spot. It is Seattle, Baltimore, Minnesota, Houston. The Tigers, after this Cubs series, do have a couple softer parts of their slate. Man, I don't know if he gets traded, and I don't think that Tigers president of baseball operations, Scott Harris, knows right now where we sit if he gets traded. And that's what's important to understand, is that's why there's no like finality to this until pencils are down and the alarms ring and the deadline is actually a deadline. Because it's going to change. It's going to change a lot. If Skubal does get dealt, where do you think he goes? Because on one hand, it is very silly to have this conversation of like who could use the best left-handed pitcher on earth. What team could use Tarek Skubal is like, well, every team could use Tarek Skubal. But what teams are in a situation where, one, they have the prospect capital, and two, they have an incentive, they are motivated, they are frankly desperate enough to go ahead and part with that prospect capital?
I mean, I can throw out some teams. The team they're playing right now, the Cubs, I think are a great fit. I don't love their prospect capital, but I'll throw them out there. I'll throw out Atlanta for sure. I think Atlanta is probably the top of my list in terms of a team in a situation with an improved farm system after a really interesting draft that they just had where they kind of restocked the farm a little bit. I think Atlanta would be at the top of my list if I had to guess right now who was most likely to try and do it and to make a big swing like that. The point that I want to make, and I want to hear who's on your mind in terms of Skubal suitors as well, but one point about this conversation that I think is important and is relevant to the thing we always say, oh, these teams are procrastinating. We say that in the context of teams adding or subtracting or making any decisions. That's all true, and that is based on their playoff odds and their records and whatever. Really what that means, though, too, and this is especially relevant for a Skubal potential trade talk, if you're interested in Skubal, and I'm sure there are teams that are, duh, as you just said, their best offers are still so far away. There's no reason for them to call Scott Harris now and offer him all of your best prospects, right? There's just no reason to do that. So I guess if you think you could overwhelm him right now, that would be a reason, but that's just not how these teams operate. So we're so far away, not just from the Tigers knowing if they're going to trade him or not, we're so far away from the teams that are interested, even constructing anything or understanding where they are comfortable going to make a deal for him. And that is related to also potentially how he's going to look over the next 2 hours. No, maybe not as much. I think we see now, we think he's probably healthy, but that's part of the conversation too. That other side of what the offers are, we're not even close to knowing what teams are willing to do yet. And that's why it makes it even harder to know which teams are going to be in the mix.
The two teams that I think owe it to themselves to consider this are Milwaukee and Tampa Bay. Two teams that tend to act more rationally, passively at the deadline. Two teams that are atop their divisions. Two teams that feel like a guarantee to be in October and, frankly, a near guarantee to have a bye in October, which I think is relevant. And two teams that could use a Tarek Skubal. The Brewers don't have Kyle Harrison right now. They are running out Logan Henderson, Shane Rohan, and Robert Gasser at the back of the rotation. I know that those are better pitchers than their name value. They're on the Brewers. That's how it goes. I would rather have Tarek Skubal come October. Similar situation going on with Tampa, with their rotation. I just think it's like with these smaller market teams that have these big farm systems, go do it. Go do the thing. Yeah. Be stupid. Be dumb. Be irrational. Live forever. Trade for Tarek Skubal. Do I think it'll happen? No, I don't. If I had to pick a team most likely to do this right now, it would still be the Dodgers. Just because their system is stacked with, I think, the types of players that the Tigers would be interested in. And the, go ahead. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, and that's just the problem is we all, the average fans, like, oh, Dodgers. Scott Harris, if he decides he's going to trade Skubal, he doesn't care what baseball fans think, where they're sending him. I don't think. Maybe there's an inkling of,
no
okay,
chance.
You don't want to send him individually, but I don't think it matters, right? If the Guardians give him the best offer, I think he's going to trade him to the Guardians if they decide he's going to trade
him. Because it's not as if this guy's going to be killing you for the next 10 years wherever you trade him, right? Like, you're trading him somewhere. Chances are he's there for, you know, 10 starts, and then you move on.
If that.
The last point I do want to make about the Skubal dynamic is that if the Tigers do trade Skubal, they're not doing it to be good in 2029 or 2030. The argument that the Tigers will make if they trade him and the argument that the Tigers will make when or if he leaves in free agency is that there is a world post-Skubal, that the Detroit Tigers franchise is not going to crumble and implode when the talented Southpaw is wearing a different uniform. This is a good farm system. They have a lot of interesting players. They can survive in a post-Skubal world. The types of players they would seek in any type of deal for Skubal, in my mind, would be more like major league contributors with team control, upper minors prospects. They're not going to, you know, acquire five high-ceiling Dominican shortstops that are 17 in the DSL, right? And I think that that is just sort of important to understand when you're talking about the types of organizations that match up with them in a trade. And because the Dodgers have all of this like high minors, big league controllable pitching, like, okay, here's, again, this is just irrational. I know it's not how it works because I watched All-Star Justin Wroblewski shove last night. Justin Wroblewski for Tarek Skubal. 1-for-1.
Yeah. I mean, I think from a value standpoint, it would be an interesting conversation. I have to imagine that no matter what this trade ends up looking like, it's going to have to include more than a 1-for-1. I just think that the optics of that and just the risk tolerance for
player
is not going to be worth it. Yeah. No, but I totally see what you're getting at when you're just talking about the value of like, okay, here's an all-star starting pitcher that's under team control for several more years compared to one who's better than that starting pitcher but is going to be gone in a couple months. So that would be that's also when we talk about the Dodgers, though, that is an option to them because they have players like Justin Wroblewski that they can trade. They have almost every kind of player to move to that could attract the Tigers. Yeah. They're not the only team with the deep farm system, but they really have, especially if we're talking about major league pitching, they have more of it that they could part with and then be fine than almost any other team.
So to wrap up this conversation, this morning, Jordan woke up on the no side of bed. I woke up on the yes side of bed, and that's because I watched the Tigers highlights before I fell asleep. Jordan, let's go ahead and take a break here. That was our Skubal chat. When we get back, we'll focus on some of the other players that are available at this deadline. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Our trade deadline preview rolls on. Let's continue asking questions. We're just asking questions, just thinking out loud. One of the ways that we love to view the deadline as it pertains to starting pitching, how many postseason starters get traded? Because when you are acquiring a pitcher at the deadline, a starting pitcher at the deadline, there are three different buckets. There are aces that rarely get traded, your Skubals, your Cliff Lees, your Randy Johnsons, your CC Sabathias. The guys that put a team on their back and say, come with me, let's go for a hike. There are guys that start postseason games that are contributors, your Jordan Montgomerys of the world, your Shane Biebers. And then there are your depth starters, the arms that you acquire because you need someone to fill innings as you tumble towards October. We talked about that first bucket, the Skubals. We will not talk about that third bucket because is, you know, 10 minutes of Michael Lorenzen fodder good podcast content? No. So let's focus on that middle ground. How many postseason starting pitchers move teams at this deadline. For context, there were three last year, maybe two, depending on how you slice it, five if you're being annoying. Shane Bieber and Zach Littell are the two pitchers that were traded at the deadline that then started games in October. Quinn Priester was traded before the deadline in the middle of the season, ended up starting a game for the Brewers. And then you had two openers in Andrew Kittredge and Louis Varland. The year before, I think the number was four starters traded at the deadline. The year before that, it was also four. So typically, it's between two and four starters at the deadline that end up starting postseason games. I think that number this year is going to be higher than normal.
Hmm. Okay, so that's related to the teams that we're talking about, and we'll keep it focused on who these pitchers are. But it is a moving target, right? Skubal is going to start a playoff game for anybody. That isn't necessarily true.
Maybe not
for
the Tigers.
Right? But maybe the Tigers. But the point is, Skubal, you don't have to ask the question, whereas a lot of these other guys are team-dependent. If the Dodgers traded for Michael Wacha, which would be very strange, but if they did, I wouldn't think he would start a postseason game. But there are a lot of other teams. If the Cubs traded for Michael Wacha, and they are still dealing with all these other injuries, I'm like, yeah, Michael Wacha might be starting game two. Yeah, so that's why it's a bit of a moving target, which is, I know. So let's just focus on who these pitchers are. We'll talk about the teams that need these guys later. But who, on an average wild card team, is really the way I'm thinking about it. Maybe a division winner that's not super duper loaded.
Sure.
Which of these guys, Foster Griffin is of course the first one that comes to mind, but even Foster Griffin, I know I'm sounding disrespectful, he's an all-star. I think that there are still some really good teams where he would be on that three line, like 3-4,
sure,
game 3 or 4 line.
Mm-hmm. But I do think it is self-selecting, though. Like, if you are the team that's willing to part with players to go acquire,
true,
Foster Griffin, the team,
yeah,
that's paying the highest price for that player is probably a team that is thinking about him as a October starter, not an innings eater.
True, true. I will say, though, the one other annoying caveat that I'll bring up, which I think is at least worth mentioning, is we say, how many starters do you need in October, right? I mean, that's a question we often said. We've seen some teams survive for quite a long time or only using 3.5 starters. But it's also, depending on what round you're in, is that starter pitching in one of your first two games in the wild card round, if you can line it up? Sometimes teams that are getting into the postseason that late can't actually decide how they're lining up their pitchers because they were going all hands on deck over the last week. I would say that is also going to be relevant for some of these teams. But I do think that your point that which teams are going to be willing to trade enough to acquire Foster Griffin, to acquire some of these other pitchers, I think it's worthwhile. That said, I do think it's a little bit of a different conversation who's willing to pay up to get Foster Griffin the rental from a rebuilding Nationals team compared to who's willing to pay up enough to get a team like the Angels to part with the Reed Detmers, to part with the Jose Soriano, because in those cases, I don't feel like those front offices are as desperate to move those guys, in which case, or maybe you could even say Minnesota with Joe Ryan. Because, yeah, if someone meets those prices, then yeah, clearly that team believes that is someone that we absolutely need or want to have starting a postseason game.
So some of the bigger names this year, obviously, Tarik Skubal. But if you're looking at the impending free agents, Kevin Gausman, Shane Bieber in Toronto, more about them later. Freddie Peralta, Clay Holmes in New York. Holmes is a option, but we'll call him impending free agent. Brady Singer, Robbie Ray, Foster Griffin. If you're looking at guys with more control, Michael Wacha, Reed Detmers, Joe Ryan, I guess Trevor Rogers on Baltimore if they decide to sell. Those are the names that we're looking at. Of this group, who interests you the most?
Yeah, so Trevor Rogers is also a free agent to be. So he's someone,
yes,
that, depending on where Baltimore goes, I know it's been a strange week for them. I think Gausman's certainly one I'm thinking a lot about now with where Toronto's at. And we can have a little bit of a longer Toronto conversation in a little bit. But that's one that, because that dude has pitched plenty in October, that he is has been as durable. He has not been as good this season as his last couple of years, indisputably. But that is still someone that I imagine there are a lot of teams that trust and are excited to get, because you feel like from a floor standpoint, he's almost as high as any of these other pitchers that you're going to get. And you could argue that the ceiling is going to be there as well. So Gausman is, now he's a little bit older for sure, but you're only signing up for these next few months. And as I mentioned, he's as durable as they come. So Gausman's certainly one I'm thinking about a lot that I didn't think I was going to be thinking about.
He, I believe, leads MLB in starts since 2022. You know, top five in strikeouts, WAR, all that stuff. Is he turning a negative corner, perhaps? But no team in baseball would feel uncomfortable starting Kevin Gausman in a playoff game. The one that I'm most interested in is Freddie Peralta. Heading into this season, when the Mets gave up a bunch to get this guy, we were like, all right, is he going to be an ace? Could he go over $200 million when he hits free agency? He has started game ones of playoff series before, and instead he has just underwhelmed. Now, everything in Mets land is toxic. Everything they touch turns to whatever the opposite of gold is, and maybe a change of scenery could do Freddie Peralta some good. What do teams think this is right now? Do they trust Freddie Peralta like a two-starter? Do they trust him like a three? Do they think he is a guy that's going to eat innings over the next couple months and then you throw him in the bullpen and have him chuck gas once the postseason begins? I think the Mets' opinion of Peralta could be so drastically different than what other teams think of him right now that, like, those trade conversations are probably going to take a while, and I think he's going to kind of be one of the last guys moved because of that dynamic. But he is the one where it's like, we never thought he was going to be on the market when this season began, right? It was like, oh, well, they're going to extend him, and he'll live in Queens happily ever after. And instead, it's like, is he good enough to start a playoff game for the Pirates? It's just such a bizarre way for this to go.
Totally agree. And your point about how long it's going to take is, I think, most relevant. But that doesn't mean I don't expect him to get traded. I think it just means that the Mets are going to have to hold on all the way till the end. I will also point out that Freddie Peralta, who just gave up five more runs against his old pals in Milwaukee, the Mets' last series before the deadline are Dodgers, Braves, and then Marlins. So maybe he gets a start against the Marlins there. But it's not like Freddie, I mean, maybe Freddie Peralta, you could view it more favorably and say, great, Freddie Peralta goes out and dominates the Dodgers or the Braves. Maybe there's some National League teams that are like, nice, that there's Freddie Peralta. Let's sign me up. Let's do
Freddie
it.
Freddie Peralta goes out that and ERA pitches against the teams he could be pitching against in October. But I don't think his ERA climbing in those starts really changes the dynamic personally, because those starts will be viewed at so hypercritically with the necessary context. No team is going to be like, oh, well, it's a five now. It's like, well, no, he was facing those teams, right? The one other guy I think is worth a little bit of time on the pitching front is Reed Detmers. Because Reed Detmers, if you look at the ERA, you're like, okay, what's the big deal? If you dig beneath the surface, Reed Detmers' peripheral numbers this year have been sensational, and is exactly the type of player that a Brewers or Rays or even Guardians type of operator would be very interested in. It just leads back to the conversation of, do the Angels trade controllable players? Where are you at, though, Jordan, on Reed Detmers as a starting pitcher right now?
Yeah, let's just focus on that, because the Angels conversation is interesting in and of itself, but Detmers has been such a sexy name that we've just been throwing out there. Now that he has been, I mean, he's been a bizarre career for this guy. That what the Angels, it seems like they've finally got him going well enough to have this conversation potentially be useful, where they can trade him for a bunch of stuff. But this is someone that was yo-yoing back and forth between the rotation and the bullpen. They could not figure out how to get him to be a valuable pitcher, really. And finally, this year, I know the ERA isn't that beautiful, but a lot of the peripherals are really good. He gets a lot of strikeouts. His slider is one of the best pitches that any lefty has, really, in the game right now. And he throws, he doesn't throw that hard, but for a lefty, it's decent velo. And when you add in the years of control and just the fact that he has this pedigree and enough stuff, that there's probably a lot of teams that have wanted to get their hands on Reed Detmers for literally his entire career, because he's been stuck in Anaheim, just floundering between roles and just dealing with all this. He's such a perfect case of, we can fix him, we can make him even better, and we'll have time to do it. Maybe he's not going to start game one of a postseason, you know, series for us this year, but there is an investment in here that is worth the cost of acquisition.
Let's move on to offense. Who's the best hitter traded? This is a particularly weak assortment of bats, a product of this winter having a soft free agent class, and the best players, the best position players in that free agent class being on contenders. Ian Happ, Seiya Suzuki in Chicago, Jazz Chisholm over in New York, Trent Grisham in New York. And so it's like, who is going to deal away good players if you're making a playoff push? A lot of names out there. We've talked about the Luis Arraez line. Does a player better than Luis Arraez get traded? Where are you at on that right now?
I still think that that's the right line to set. I think that when we start talking about, and overall trade value is a different conversation, because guys with more team control, you have to acknowledge. But even if we're just thinking about it as the best player in 2026 that is going to make the biggest impact for the rest of the season as a position player, is Luis Arraez at the top of that list? I still think he is the favorite right now. But all these catchers getting floated around there, you could argue that Ryan Jeffers is a better player than Luis Arraez when you consider just the combination of offense and defense from a more premium position. He just homered again last night, and he's back from, remember, he was out for a month, and it looked like, okay, is Jeffers going to come back? We'll see what happens with the Twins. Some interesting other catchers being floated out there. Hunter Goodman, that's part of what the Rockies be willing to move someone with a lot of years control. That'd be pretty extreme. Shea Langeliers is a name I'm looking at with the A's, who seems unlikely to extend with them as a Boris client and who's 2 years away from free agency. That's a huge, that would be, of course. I mean, he's top 10 MVP candidate right now. So I still think Arraez is the answer right now, because I know he's going to get traded, and a lot of these other guys, it's just speculation. Are there any other hitters that you could make a case for as both likely to be traded and likely or better than Luis Arraez?
There is one. A player that I think we have forgotten about. A player that we have forgotten about for good reason. A player that has only re-entered our consciousness over the last 2 days, and that is Luis Robert Jr. Mm-hmm. Luis Robert Jr., yes. Who missed multiple months, yep. His annual multiple month injury stint with the Mets, came back Monday, hit a ball 451 yesterday. Right-handed hitting outfielder in a market with not a lot of power and not a lot of right-handed hitting outfielders, who has a $20 million team option for next year that is just not going to get picked up. Certainly not by the Mets, I think. And you're looking at him as a rental. I mean, if you want game-changing talent, that's the guy. Now, we've been saying, well, what could Luis Robert be for like a decade at this point? And the idea of Luis Robert is perpetually outpacing the reality of Luis Robert. I understand that. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking for guys that can move a needle and take over a playoff series and be a real game-changing force, Luis Robert Jr. is a very interesting character. How he looks between now and the deadline. I mean, if you're talking about player performance between now and the deadline, he might be number one in the sport in terms of most. Like, if he just goes on a heater and he looks fully healthy, like, that's an everyday player. There are not a lot of everyday players available on the market, particularly from the right-handed side. The funniest thing is, you know what would be a great fit? The Chicago White Sox.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly correct. Trade talks would go. I know that the team option we're thinking about is a pending free agent. he is making a lot of money this year too. And so I imagine for certain teams, there might be some level of conversation there in terms of how much you're
taking on.
How much
would the Mets pay it down to get a better prospect? It's $5.9 million for the rest of the year, $20 million option for next year. The Mets are a team that you'd think would be willing to pay it off for this season in order to get a better player back.
You would, but we also had a very direct report from Joel Sherman this week saying the Mets are not looking to pay down contracts anymore this season. I still agree with you. I think this would be a great case where you would want to do that, especially because if there's one thing the Mets have learned about this season, as disastrous as it's been, their outfield is in pretty good shape. With Benjamin Ewing and Juan Soto, that's their group. There's a lot of questions literally for the entire rest of the roster, which is why I would not be feeling awesome if I'm a Mets fan. But the outfield seems to have been in good shape, and why now, whatever, we'll move Ewing around while Luis Robert tries to inflate his trade value. So I totally agree. I definitely wanted to bring him up. That home run he hit certainly reminded me of that. I will say in the outfield, a couple other names to mention. Taylor Ward is someone.
It is so funny to me that like the Mets have been like, Ewing's our guy. We love him. It's great. And then they're like, hey, AJ, for the next 10 days, we need to fatten the cow for market. We need to just make the world think that Luis Robert Jr. is great. We apologize. This is what we're doing. Like, that's it.
You'll be here.
And that's why I think
you'll be back in center field for a long time, just not for the next 4 weeks.
You're out there. But it is such a funny dynamic that you see it like it. Kind of done in a softer way, but that's why this guy has to get traded, because there's not room for him in this outfield.
Like, Benj
and Ewing need to be playing every day, and Juan Soto is the best hitter in the National League, and so it's like Luis Robert Jr. is going to be wearing other colors in 11 days.
Yep, totally agree. A couple other hitters to mention, then we'll move to teams. Taylor Ward is one I've brought up several times. I think he's relevant now. It's been a weird year for him, too, because of how little power he's been producing. But someone that's getting on base, and I imagine is also from a floor standpoint, raise the floor of a lineup and maybe even raise the ceiling. I think he's in the mix there, even if he's not bringing the defense. And then one name I'm also watching closely, depending on how these next couple weeks go, for a team that could maybe go in either direction, although I don't expect them to be buyers, is Lars Nootbaar with St. Louis. That's someone who has come back and looked very good since he returned from injury. He had surgery on both feet, both heels, I think, over the offseason. So he missed the first couple months, but he's been very good.
Very Stantonian,
which is not obviously a compliment from a health standpoint. That said, this is a good, really good baseball player who is under team control for next year. And I could see him being another Brendan Donovan type move where it's like, we love you, dude, but we're getting huge offers for you right now, and you don't necessarily fit quite with the same timeline. Now, I know Lars Nootbaar loves it there. I know they love him. So maybe they find a way to keep him there long term. But in a market light on hitters, if he's healthy and playing well and the Cardinals start to fall out of it, which I think is extremely possible, I have to think that they're going to be getting some really strong offers for him. And I think he is a better baseball player than Luis Arraez.
Okay. Let's finish up with Mason Miller. Miller, Division III baseball legend, throwing 103 in the big leagues. Mason Miller, the main character of last year's trade deadline, going from the A's to the Padres in exchange for a package led by Leo DeVries, one of the best infield prospects in the sport. The Padres are in a weird spot. They have been on quite a schneid. They won last night. I believe they are now 2 games adrift of the final and a wild card spot. There are a number of teams between them and that spot, which muddies the waters. Mason Miller's name has popped up in trade talks again, despite the fact that he is under team control for the rest of this year and then 3 more seasons. Okay. 1, why would the Padres trade this guy away? And 2, will they?
Well, I think if they do this, it's basically going to be just a version of... Now, it's different, I know, because he is under multiple years of team control. But I think it would be viewed in the same way as trading Juan Soto again would be. Which is, yes, we gave up a ton to get this guy, but now he can help us fill out the rest of the roster for the long term better than he can himself just throwing the ninth inning. and we're getting all these crazy offers for him. And so I'm just trying to keep extending this very strange window that may or may not be closing due to many external and internal factors involving not just the division, but the ownership group and the roster itself and all the contracts that they've already given out and are now stuck with. That is why I think they would do it. We've only seen AJ Preller, other than that Juan Soto trade, which was a very unique trade because it also brought back real major league players, only act as a buyer. That's just all he does, is trade away prospects for major leaguers. So this would be a deviation, especially in season.
In season.
It would be very different. Very different. But maybe AJ Preller wants to try something new and wants to trade. And now I also don't even know. We just assume, okay, well, just because Mason Miller has been every bit as good as he was when they traded for him last year, better. He would also get better. A top 10 prospect. Better. I don't know if that means he would get you a top 10 prospect. I think that it took a really extreme set of circumstances and literally AJ Preller himself, a unique Pobo.
The most extreme circumstance.
Correct. Just because Mason Miller, everyone agrees he is this good, he is still a reliever. He still comes with a lot of associated risk that I don't think it's just like, okay, well, great. Now you can just trade him for another time. I don't think it's that simple. I really don't. And so that alone might make it less likely for it to happen. But if the Padres keep playing poorly, which I just, at this point, I just don't think they're that good of a team, I guess they'd have to consider it. But I'm having a hard time talking about the Padres' direction and Preller's job security. And they're a tough team to evaluate for a lot of reasons.
Last year, I was adamant that the A's would not trade Mason Miller. I ended up looking like a dunce. And so I am wary of making bold statements this time around. However, I will say this. I would be shocked, floored, flabbergasted if Mason Miller was traded for prospects. If Mason Miller gets traded, I think it will be for big league players that can
like
give
Michael
the
King,
Padres,
right?
Like Michael King, like Randy Vasquez, the pieces that came back in the Soto deal. Because I do think that AJ Preller's job security and the state of this franchise is a vital character here. Because AJ Preller is not going, probably, to be the person that rebuilds the next era of the Padres. Whenever this party ends and the lights turn on and people leave and the Padres need to enter a new era, it is difficult to imagine AJ Preller being the one to rebuild the foundation. And so what is his personal incentive to trade Mason Miller for a future that he might not be around for? Does that mean that Mason Miller doesn't get? Yeah, I still think, he could totally get traded. You can never say never with AJ Preller. But the one thing I think you could say never about is him acquiring prospects. That is a never. That is the thing I cannot remember him doing in the last, 5 years. So do I think Mason Miller gets traded? No. Am I ready to be wrong again? Always. Let's take a break. And when we get back, we'll finish up by looking at the deadline through a team perspective. Welcome back to the end of this deadline preview bonanza. We'll finish things up by going back and forth. Very simple question. What teams compel you? Who's tickling your fancy? Who are you thinking about at deadline time going, what in the world are they going to do? How are they going to operate? What's that Pobo going to pull off to shock us? I'll let you start.
Let's do Toronto. I think we alluded to it bringing up Gausman earlier. This is one of the stranger follow-ups to a breakout season that I can really remember. And the biggest question that I have with them is, because for last month, I would say, well, this is the last team I would expect to sell. I mean, they just went to the World Series. They owe their fans. They're selling out every game. They should be trying to go for it, especially in this crappy American League. But the more I think about it and the more I talk to people around the Blue Jays, it's like, they don't have it. It's not happening. Sorry. Like, this team is not going anywhere anytime soon. And with a number of very intriguing expiring contracts, do they actually have the cachet to pull off a sell, a soft sell, or a, you know, we're not, you know, getting rid of guys with long-term deals.
A reboot.
A reboot. They've done it before in the last 5 years. Remember, they have kind of gone up and down in dramatic fashion. I'm leaning towards yes. I think that they could say, look, I don't think Ross Atkins is worried about saving his job. We just talked about how great their offseason was this past year with Cease and Okamoto and Rogers, whatever. So I think that as painful as it's going to be to trade Kevin Gausman, who is one of the best free agent signings of the decade and has meant so much to Toronto and et cetera, as much as it might pain them to trade a Dalton Varsho, who's also an expiring contract, a George Springer, think about what he's meant to them. And I know that those guys don't have as much value because of the seasons that they're having as maybe a Kevin Gausman does. I think that those are hard conversations that they're probably leaning towards making. Because I this does not seem like a team that has even if they could stay within a few games of a playoff spot, I just doesn't seem like a team that has it, that has a run in them. And so I think that they have the room to make that tough decision.
Yesterday, I went on Jays Talk Plus with our friend Blake Murphy, and he was asking me about the Jays deadline. And over the course of our conversation, I slowly, gradually realized that, oh, my God, this team is not good. They need to trade everybody. You know, right. I was like, wait a second. They have to trade these people. And it will be odd to explain to your casual ball watching buddies that the team that was inches from winning the World Series and has a very similar roster with a bunch of good offseason additions is selling at the deadline. But I think it is definitely what they have to do. I mentioned Bieber before. I think Jeff Hoffman could move. Varsho is like one of the few everyday players. Like, he could be a fun fit for the White Sox. Mm-hmm. I am just, the Jays are in a very odd spot. I am, yeah, also fascinated by them.
They're last thing I'll say on them, and then you can give me a team. I mean, it's closer to the Mets than anything. Yeah. I mean, it's also a disaster. You spent all this money. You had all these high expectations. But with the Mets, we're like, well, yeah, they suck. Like, trade everybody. Duh. This is not a hard conversation. And it took me a few weeks to get there with Toronto, but I think I am there now.
I will go with the Brewers. Do it, man. Be dumb. I am so affected and my brain is so warped by how the Brewers operated, not operated, by how the Brewers showed in October last year against the Dodgers. The team that they had assembled, the team that won the most games in the sport, just got steamrolled by the Dodgers in that NLCS. And I am curious to see if that experience changes the way that Matt Arnold, this hobo, goes about his business at this deadline. Does he say, you know what? I can roll out of bed and build a 97-win ball club, but do I need to change course and be more aggressive and be more stupid and get more MFers, more game changers in order to win a playoff series, in order to slay the dragon that is the Dodgers? Because if the Brewers want to win a World Series, which is the ultimate goal, they're probably going to need to beat the Los Angeles Dodgers. And in order to beat the Los Angeles Dodgers, you need these big players. We saw it with the Blue Jays in the World Series, how close they almost came, right? Bichette and Guerrero were like these aircraft carriers. Do the Brewers have those players? Are those players available? Are they willing to go get them? That is why I think the Brewers and Skubal, like, will they trade for Skubal? No. Should they? I think so. How aggressive they, and you can loop Tampa into this too, how aggressive will these teams be with the opportunity in front of them?
Yeah, I was going to say Tampa. You can lump Cleveland in because those three organizations, we just have very similar conversations about all the time. Now, Cleveland is not having nearly as good of a season as Milwaukee and Tampa Bay. So I think that from that perspective, it's different. Right. But it's still the same idea of you have plenty of stuff to trade and clear needs, and you were expecting to be back in the postseason. And in Cleveland's case, the urgency should be even higher because you clearly actually have some competition as opposed to Milwaukee and Tampa, which might cruise to a postseason spot. Cleveland might actually need to do something.
Okay. I disagree with that because I think Tampa is actually the team here with the most incentive to be hyper aggressive. And I think that they will be. The AL stinks. They're going to be in a bye. Cleveland might not be in a bye. Mm-hmm. Like Tampa will be in a bye. And then they'll have a pretty weak American League field to have to go through. This is as good of an opportunity as this organization has had to reach a World Series since they reached the World Series. And if you don't take advantage of that, I think it's a big swing and a miss. So I'll just take both those teams. I'll take the Brewers and the Rays together. Your turn.
Great. So then I will take your lead there, and I will also take two teams, and I'll do the Rockies and Angels together. Because with both of these franchises, two of the on the short list of, okay, these teams suck, they should obviously sell players. However, that has been true in the past, and they have not done so because they have been acting as if they are living in an alternate universe where actually they're close to contending and they can't possibly trade away players on their major league team because they're just a couple pieces away from getting back into it. That is no longer the case. Now they have new leadership in the front office that is seeing things clearly and are recognizing we are bad now, and holding on to these players that have even 2 or 3 years of team control, when you consider the larger scope of this organizational direction and trajectory and what we need, we have to consider all options. John Mozeliak has come out very publicly already, seemingly every other day for the last 2 weeks, saying, yes, we have to consider all of these things, which is why I do think they are going to trade at least one of these players with multiple years of team control, whether that's Detmers, whether that's Soriano, whether that's Joe Adele or Zach Neto. I have to think that teams now are going to know we can call the Angels and actually have a real conversation with them in a way that we couldn't in the past. And I think that that's also true with the Rockies. I think the Rockies are a little bit different because they don't have as many pieces of the same trade value level as the Detmers and Soriano types or even a Neto. But I think they're also going to consider a lot of things that they didn't in the past. We already saw them part with a reliever with real upside in Seth Halverson. A lot of risk as well with injuries and strike throwing, but that was the first trade where, with the Dodgers, a team they haven't made a trade with since 2014, they go get a couple of interesting prospects there. I have to think they're going to keep looking at their other relievers, whether it's Juan Mejia or Victor Vodnik or Jaden Hill, that other teams are going to call about and be like, yes, we of course should consider trading these guys for real prospects, because why wouldn't we? It's just the sensible thing to do. So the degree to which both of these teams are willing to part with real pieces is, I think, one of the biggest questions of this whole deadline. And I do think it is going to happen, especially in Anaheim.
The John Mozeliak dynamic is so funny right now because it feels like every 3 days we're getting a quote from him where he's like, we stink and we're going to have to trade some people. And it's as if the Angels reporters can't believe that the person in charge is saying that and being that honest and realistic. And so they then need to just continue to like check in. Hey, John, just following up. Really? Because we're not used to hearing that line of messaging.
He's like,
it cracks me up. He's like, no, dude, look at this. You're watching this team. The team I'll go with next is the New York Mets. They'll trade all of the expiring contracts that they can. That's a no-brainer. This team is underwhelmed to an embarrassing degree. That is Holmes. That is Freddie Peralta. That is Brooks Raley. That might be Tyrone Taylor, Luis Robert Jr. So then the question becomes, what else? Do they go further than that? And if so, what does that look like? Is that Francisco Alvarez? Do they cut bait on Beatty or Mark Vientos? Do they try and get out from the Bo Bichette deal? Do they trade Francisco Lindor? I think no. If we're talking like who is safe, like who would I bet a limb will be on the 2027 Mets. Ewing, Soto, Benj, McClain.
Yeah. That's probably the end of the list.
Thanks for showing up. Christian Scott, probably. You know?
Christian Scott.
Like, that's...
Yes.
That's the list. What is so fascinating about the Mets to me is that how David Stearns, their Pobo, moves this deadline, the moves that he makes, the players he gets back, the players he trades away, this is his biggest opportunity, the beginning of the process of him saving face, rehabilitating his reputation as a baseball executive. We thought that this guy knew what he was doing. Maybe he still does. Certainly hasn't looked like that over the last 2 years. The proof is in the pudding and in the run differential and in the standings. The Mets have been an embarrassment. If David Stearns is going to fix this thing, that starts over the next 10 days. And I am fascinated to see him operate from this position as a seller,
yeah,
as a true seller.
Yeah.
And so there is actually probably no single character behind Skubal that I'm more compelled by than David Stearns at this deadline.
I agree with you that Stearns as a character, just his place and reputation, I'm with you on all that. I don't really know what trades he could make. I mean, I guess, yeah, you trade Freddy Peralta for like a top 50 prospect. Mets fans temporarily will be like, hell yeah, Stearns cooked. And then they'll be like, man, we suck. Hopefully we're better next year. Like, I don't know how much he can really fix
sure,
it, but I do
like,
agree with your larger
what
point. Yeah.
Types of players are they trying to acquire?
Sure. Yes.
How high up the minor league ladder are they? Are they young players at the big league level? We're going to learn a lot about what David Stearns believes is the path from here to there, from where the Mets have found themselves to where the Mets want to be. And so for that reason, like we're just going to learn so much about the Mets that I'm hooked.
Sure.
Who's your last team that's tickling your
fancy? Yeah. So I'm going to finish with two teams. Listen, you could lean in a lot of directions. Okay. Clear buyer, clear seller, right? Giants, how many guys they trade? Some of the teams that are stuck in the middle are going to figure it out in the next couple of weeks. But the two teams that I'm going to lump together, maybe it's unfair, are the White Sox and Pirates. I think that those two teams have clearly played themselves into clearly buyers, but what does that really look like? How bad do you want it? It's different for both of them because the White Sox have less in front of them to deal with. They have this opportunity to maybe win the division. Oh my goodness, that's a shocking opportunity that they could really have. How badly do they want to chase that? The Pirates, it's a steeper hill to climb because of the more crowded National League and the division that they're in. But I think the Pirates are pretty good. And the Pirates had the longest playoff drought in the National League with a chance to end it. So the urgency for both of those front offices, the vibes are, I think, still better with the White Sox because expectations were so low. So I don't think there's as much pressure on that front office to make stuff happen in the way that the Pirates, I think that there is real pressure. But for both of those reasons, because of where they are now at with the opportunities in front of them and the varying levels of pressure, those are teams I hope are busy, I hope are aggressive, but let's see if they can actually pull it off.
It's a good pick. I'll finish up with the Washington Nationals. The Washington Nationals are 51-51. They are at 500. That is a remarkable thing. A team that entered the year with a new front office, a new regime, and very low expectations in terms of wins and losses has played far above their skis. What did they decide to do? Should they trade Foster Griffin, an impending free agent, or should they hold on to him? Should they trade Luis Garcia Jr., who has been one of the best hitters in baseball over the last 2 months and has some team control? Do they go as far as trading CJ Abrams? Here is an argument that I'm going to make. Do I totally believe in it? I'm not sure. Just hear me out. The Nationals should not trade Foster Griffin. I think that there is real value to not kicking your fan base in the head. A fan base that has suffered and wallowed over the last 6-7 seasons. a fan base that has watched some awful baseball, a fan base that for the first time in a long time has been presented with a morsel of hope, legitimate optimism. If you trade Foster Griffin, you're telling that fan base, sorry. What you're also doing is you're telling the players on your team, sorry. Pack it in second half. And I think that this Nationals operation, to its benefit, has revolved around a sense of humanity and interpersonal relationships to reach the development that they have imparted onto these players. These players have gotten a lot better. And it is not necessarily because of like the changes that they're making. It's how they're making those changes. Like the Nats are like existing with this sense of trust that they've fostered. No pun intended. Hashtag Foster Griffin. I think that training Foster Griffin would send a weird message internally to that group. And I'm not saying like, oh, they trade Foster Griffin and CJ Abrams is going to turn into a pumpkin for the second half. Like it's more complicated than that. But it's also not. Like that stuff does matter. And I think it matters more than normal for the Nats. And so I think that we could see a scenario where they don't trade Foster Griffin and people are like, what in the world are they doing? And it would make a little bit more sense than meets the eye.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to how we began this whole podcast. It is just going to depend, I think, how that's received if they are a game and a half back on August 2nd, right? It's, you know, if they're not, which is very possible, if they are, we'll see. We'll see.
It's not even about making the playoffs this year. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's what's so interesting is like the Nats are focused on the bigger picture and on the long term. And there is an argument that it is better for the long term health of the organization to keep Foster Griffin around, to teach your players how to play in a relative playoff race, to continue to grow this culture of development, than whatever prospect you're going to get back for Foster Griffin.
Sure. That's totally valid. And we'll see if Mr. Poboni agrees.
And it goes even further with those other players. Like if they trade Garcia or Abrams, then it's an even stronger message in the other direction.
Have fun with that, Paul Toboni. That's why take that on. You got some tough decisions to make. But I think these are mostly good problems to have for the 51-51 2026 Washington Nationals. Oh my goodness. Wow. Good for them. That's it. There is our trade deadline preview a little under 2 weeks out. Yep.
I would never trade you, bro.
Oh, thanks, man. Hopefully that is not being said to players that are about to be traded in the next 2 weeks, but might be. Hopefully not. For everybody just remember, everybody, we are going to be live on the trade deadline day leading up to the deadline on YouTube. Make sure you're subscribed to the new Yahoo Sports MLB YouTube channel, Yahoo Sports MLB. You can find all things baseball barbercast. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing. As always, we'll be back on Friday catching up on some more news. Until then, see you soon.